hold it even with the microphone. This is for something else then.
That's something else.
Okay, perfect. All right, as everyone is able to hear me in the back just fine. Great. As Mary said, I'm James Palmer. I live in Medford. I'm originally from about an hour south of Salt Lake City in Utah, actually, though. So I come by way of a couple of different stops. I am a child psychiatry fellow, meaning I've done undergrad the 4 years in that medical school in Iowa and down to Arizona for general psychiatry, which ends up being 3 to 4 additional years of specialization, and now specifically to kids and adolescents. I grew up in Utah with a bit of a it wasn't a small town, but a large family. And I think that's where the interest that I have to working with kids and adolescents started. I lived for a couple years down in Brazil, and being able to appreciate a lot of different perspectives when it comes to how we think about a family has really informed my interest in working with kids and adolescents and their families to this point. I'm very excited to be here with DBSA, and I'm very impressed with the work that goes on that you all provide, and that I'm honored to be a part of that tonight. And welcome any sort of feedback that you all have. If there are questions, I'm told that it works best if we wait until the end for those questions, but certainly if there's something burning that we need to address right away, then certainly do let me know. Being a child psychiatry fellow, that means I'm still in training. So there are certainly people who have finished their training and are even more specialized than I am to answer some questions. So there are certainly a lot of limitations to my knowledge. But that being said, I am excited to be here, and wanted to disclose that I have no financial disclosures. And that kind of the goal tonight is to go back to thinking a little bit about how we would think about kids, about irritability in particular, what that means. And so in thinking about a kid that's irritable, I'm wondering kind of what that brings up to mind for people. If you're thinking about an irritable kid in the grocery store, are we thinking of a kid in the grocery store? Are we thinking, you know, a 3 or 4 year old that's throwing a tantrum over, you know, wanting 25 cents to get a gumball, or 50 cents if the price has gone up nowadays? Or are we thinking of more of a sullen, withdrawn, sort of a 16 or 17 year old with earbuds in or something like that, that really isn't all that interested in having much of a conversation? So I'm wondering a lot about what comes to mind when we're thinking about an irritable child. In child psychiatry, we're often asked to work with kids that are angry, that are irritable, and I wonder if we think that irritable and angry are synonymous. I think that's part of what we would think about as we kind of come along here today. But if we're thinking about an irritable child, and we have kind of some different thoughts that maybe come to mind, or we have our own child, or we ourselves think that we were an irritable child perhaps, then it may lead us to a bit of an internet search. And so I thought about different descriptors of children. And so here are a couple of books that... Oh, I am seeing that it's not showing up here. That's a problem. So you guys weren't even recognizing that I had all sorts of fancy slides up to this point. The sad thing is that the best parts of the slides have already passed, and those first two, the title slide and everything.
I'm so sorry. What are we doing wrong?
Let's see.
It's there. Yeah.
There sometimes is a button that we can push, like that one. No. Or function in that one.
So, are any of these things you want?
I don't know how to get it up here. There's usually another button. Let's
project.
How about that?
Is that what you want?
That's what we want.
Phew.
Now I've got to put it up here so that you're not seeing all the notes that I'm supposed to remember to say underneath it.
Okay.
So here we go. Now we're going to look a little bit differently here. So when we're looking at this, I don't want to be in the way as far as everyone's seeing here, but I'm wondering kind of if maybe some of these are some of the thoughts of other descriptors of children, and I'm wondering if we're thinking that they look a little bit different perhaps than an irritable child. We see that there's a highly sensitive child, for example, who has a mom that's given the kid a kiss there. I mean, this is to help our child thrive when the world overwhelms them. Or, for example, raising a spirited child. This is for a guide for parents whose child is more intense, sensitive, perceptive, persistent, and energetic. How about the angry child? Regaining control when your child is out of control. So a little bit of a different one. Or maybe the explosive child. A new approach for understanding and parenting easily frustrated, chronically irritable children. The out of sync child. We only get to see one eye of the out of sync child. But that child, we're trying to help recognize and cope with sensory processing disorder. Or the whole brain child. All of these were coming up as far as thinking about irritable children when I was kind of Googling and looking into what sorts of books. Or the sensory sensitive child, practical solutions for out of bounds behavior. So I wonder if a lot of these thoughts, a lot of these books would perhaps lead us to thinking about how we actually think about kids and how other people that are looking up for help may be thinking about kids. But I'm also wondering, What our thoughts are about the different sorts of ideas that come to mind about if we're describing a child as irritable as opposed to out of sync or spirited, when ultimately it seems like actually we're talking about a sensitive, perceptive, persistent, energetic, more intense sort of a kid. But if that ends up actually being maybe kind of similar to what an irritable child may be. A lot of times these books may be accessed by hopeful, well-intending parents or caregivers thinking about how to work with a child that may be irritable. So I'm wondering a little bit about how we think about what's in a name then. If we're thinking about a child as far as being energetic instead of irritable, if there's a difference in terms of how we think about that child, if we think that maybe there is a difference. I mean, I think about it maybe even in terms of other sorts of characteristics. I'm certainly not saying that irritable is particularly a diagnosis at all. In fact, we'll get to that point maybe here in a little bit. But or that a spirited child or a highly energetic child or an out-of-sync child is a particular diagnosis. But it certainly is a descriptor. So I'm thinking of other sorts of descriptors like pneumonia or diabetes, for example. And when we think of that, both of those certainly come with constellations of symptoms, right? Pneumonia, maybe you're having a hard time breathing. Maybe it's hurting when you're coughing. Maybe you have a fever, right? Or as far as diabetes, maybe you're peeing a lot. Or maybe you're sensing some tingling. Maybe there are changes in vision that kind of come along. Maybe those came, and that would be part of the question as far as how we came to recognizing that we had pneumonia or that we had diabetes. But I'm wondering, as far as when we found that up, would we start to say that I'm a diabetic or I'm a pneumoniac? And what sort of a benefit that it had to have that particular diagnosis to know that actually you have pneumonia and that there is a treatment for pneumonia or a treatment for diabetes? And thinking about that, did finding out that that person had pneumonia or diabetes provide some sort of clarity, provide some sort of sense of hope, perhaps, some sort of idea about how to proceed or not to proceed? Certainly, if you're treating a diabetic with the same treatment as far as you would be doing for someone that has pneumonia, the outcomes may not be as favorable, that it wouldn't necessarily be interchangeable. But I do wonder if that does provide some sort of a frame around it. In terms of a diagnosis, it ends up being a little bit easier with pneumonia and diabetes, for example. Pneumonia, you can take a chest x-ray, kind of see if there's a lobular focus, or diabetes, you take a blood sugar and kind of see how it's been elevated, or you can take a couple, depending on which way you're going about it. And there's something that you can clearly see. And yet at the same time, I think about diagnoses like anxiety, depression, or bipolar disorder, and what sorts of thoughts come to mind with those sorts of diagnoses? Maybe what sorts of thoughts came before you had the idea of what it was to be depressed, or had a name for it, or to have bipolar disorder. And I'm wondering what that ends up being and what that provides in terms of clarity. And I mention that because a lot of times in mental health, we end up trying to find diagnoses. A lot of times I'm asked, so what is it? What explains this irritable child? And at the outset, I make a caveat, of course, that being a child and adolescent psychiatrist, I'm talking specifically about child and adolescent topics. But at the same time, we'll see that actually it relates to adults quite a bit. And that for many people, onset may have been a little bit earlier. But when we think about a diagnosis for someone that has, you know, a painful cough and a fever, or someone that is peeing a lot, or that has lost a lot of weight, as it may be with diabetes, then we may think that it's helpful to actually know why this is happening. And that's part of the idea that a diagnosis could potentially offer. And that would be part of the question that I have as we've been kind of thinking about this together, as to if that's what that sort of a thought provided or did not provide for you or for a loved one at any point in your life. So this, of course, is the DSM. I'm wondering if it is likely known to many of you or all of you as far as what it is, right? The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's fifth edition, right? The first edition being back in 1952, actually. And in terms of its content, it has expanded quite a bit. The last version of the DSM, the DSM-4, was about 20 years ago. There was a task force put together to try and look about what's with, you know, not having anything. Have things stayed stagnant since 20 years ago when the last version was put forth? The idea being that, of course, it provides a common manual, so, or a common set of language. So if you, well, for example, in terms of diagnoses, it spans everything from neurodevelopmental disorders, like intellectual disability is what it's called nowadays in the DSM-5 instead of former diagnoses like mental retardation, to speech sound disorders, to other conditions that may be of a focus of clinical attention, like relational problems. So it spans quite a bit, has all sorts of pages, has all sorts of criteria. And that's the point with all of this, is that where in psychiatry we often want to make sure we're ruling out a medical cause for any sort of symptoms that we're having, oftentimes it ends up coming back to what cluster of symptoms are we having. And that cluster put together is all very well known. Ends up coming to a diagnosis. And that can lead us to part of that question as far as what we think about that diagnosis, what it means. Does it provide some clarification? Does it provide some hope? Does it provide us with an idea of what a treatment may be? And so coming along to that, I think it brings us back to the initial slide that I was asking about the irritable child. And thinking about it, was this kid in the grocery store that we have decided is the irritable child? Part of the question, so the DSM was very kind in providing a specific definition for us, that irritable means that this is easily annoyed and provoked to anger. But the question of this is, what actually could the irritability be? Is the irritability the root or actually a branch to this tree of a person? And in the next slide, actually, we can look at that a little bit more. How is that severity looking for this person? This is a little bit of a treatment idea for a lot of primary care doctors or pediatricians, where they're tasked many times with trying to figure out, is this an atypical or a typical sort of irritability? Is this something that we'd expect for a three-year-old, to be mad about not getting a gumball? Or is this something that persists beyond what we would actually think to be typical? And so it asks certain questions that are common across all disorders, be them pneumonia, diabetes, or into the mental health realm. Looking at how long has this been happening, what sorts of behaviors actually are problematic, what brings it on, what makes it go away, what's the result of it? Is there any sort of substance use affiliated or associated with it? What sort of impairment may be part of it? And this comes about by talking with a parent, being a child or a caregiver, as well as looking and actually meeting with the child. And so as we follow along, these are some of the questions that we would ask here on the left side as you're looking at it. And then we think about it, that there's going to be direct observation, that there's going to be talking with teachers and schools, and that sometimes there are scales that kind of give us a bit of an idea as to some of these questions about how severe is it, how frequently is it happening, how impairing is it. Similarly, there are specific specialists in terms of psychological evaluations, neuropsychologists that can do a special testing around some of these areas to rule some things out, as well as the part that I mentioned about a medical workup. Is this part of a kid having eaten a bunch of paint, actually, and having lead toxicity? Are we thinking that there is something as far as heavy metal exposure? Is this a thyroid problem? Is this a kid with a really low vitamin D level that may be contributing to it? Is there anemia? So there are various sorts of, or is there a brain mass for that matter? What are the potential contributors that we need to make sure we're ruling out before we're defining whether this is normal or abnormal, typical or atypical irritability? In the same sort of a way, there are a bunch of different disorders, if we are saying that it is an atypical irritability when it comes to what is it? Everything from intellectual disability, as I mentioned before, that likely is going to become more apparent depending on the severity at an early age, but may not become apparent until the sixth or seventh grade, perhaps. But that irritability may be manifesting because the kid is just getting frustrated that he or she can't get the schoolwork done that they would want to, and there are certain expectations they're mad because they would like to complete them, but they just can't figure it out. Furthering along to adjustment disorders, that there are specific triggers that have really brought this on that have happened recently. We talked about some of the neurocognitive, ADHD being another part, that there is an impulse control difficulty, autism spectrum disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, or a latecomer, a newcomer, I guess, to the DSM and the DSM-5, this disruptive mood dysregulation disorder that, without trying to spoil too much, may be a part of our presentation today, actually, being a newcomer. Along with some of the other parts that we have here, everything coming through conduct disorder to PTSD, depression, down to schizophrenia or substance use disorders. One other point that I highlight is another common descriptor that actually came up quite a bit was bipolar disorder. In fact, in part of the difficulty, and a major part of the difficulty that the field of child psychiatry was finding, was how to define, how to understand what is irritability. And so what happened is, for many time, actually here locally, there were a lot of thoughts that this actually fit in to a pediatric bipolar disorder, and that this was actually different in many respects than adult bipolar disorder. And this table highlights that difference, and will be a part that we'll talk about a little bit more, that this irritability was severe, but that it manifests as more of a mixture of depressive and manic symptoms that were co-occurring day in and day out. That this often just didn't go away, and we'll get to this at certain points, but this table is to highlight that when we're thinking about adults, we're thinking that often there is an episodic nature to it, as opposed to the original thought that came about in the mid-90s, that actually a pediatric bipolar disorder was notably and distinctly different. So what's the outcome of that, I guess? The fact that it was thought to be different was that the treatment would be different. Specifically, one study that followed this identification of pediatric bipolar disorder in the 90s was that there were a lot of the visits for bipolar disorder that there were multiple medications used to treat, which ends up being fairly common for adult bipolar disorders also. But there was the concern that, given that this was an early onset, that over time, with many years, that there was an increase of side effects. The more exposure you have, the longer the side effects accumulate, essentially, and that some of the side effects were notably different in kids as opposed to adults. And so what that manifests as when it started to become a more commonly diagnosed and recognized disorder or illness in the child population was exactly this, that when this started to come about in the mid-90s, as I mentioned, it was considered to be a very, very rare sort of an illness, a quarter of a percent, if I'm reading that right, 25 people per 100,000. But with the research that was coming about in less than 10 years, it had gone up by 40 times in less than 10 years, and that it was two-thirds of those that were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, pediatric bipolar disorder specifically, were male. Given that same time, when we're thinking about, well, is this actually different from adults with bipolar disorder in this same time frame, we actually look at the time in the mid-90s, that it was, you know, almost 1%, but given that same 8-year elapse, that it went up to 1.7%, which is still a significant increase, right? Almost 2%, or almost 2 times of an increase. But notably, that was almost proportionately same female as opposed to male when we're looking at the pediatric side of it. But I'm sure we can all agree that a 40 times increase is significantly bigger than a 2 times increase. And so that was a big part of consternation for the field of child psychiatry, because often when there's a diagnosis such as this, then, because there's such a level of impairment that's happening, it requires a certain level of treatment. And so that's where that previous slide pointed out that many of those visits had multiple medications. And that's the part that led people to start to think a little bit more about this. And so drilling down to diagnostic criteria that you're all, I'm sure, quite familiar with, in lived experience of yourself or someone that you love, is that in order to diagnose a bipolar disorder, or in the next slide, bipolar 2 disorder, there either has to be mania or hypomania. And in terms of defining this, again, the DSM says that this has some of those features that are a little bit different, but do include an irritable mood that we've talked about so far already, that is abnormally and persistently increased at least 1 week, unless you're hospitalized, right? And that happens most of the day, nearly every day. There are some other associated potential symptoms with that. But that's kind of that big part that links back to the irritability. Another part that, of course, we would highlight is the episodic nature to it. And we'll get that with this next slide, because along with hypomania, right, just under the threshold as far as a full manic episode, is that this one is at least 4 consecutive days, again, most of the day, every day, that's persistently elevated throughout that time, again with the irritability. And notably, when we come down to some of these specifiers that are not specifiers, but other parts that are consistent with bipolar disorder, it has an unequivocal change in functioning that is uncharacteristic of the individual when not symptomatic. Similarly, that there is a change in functioning that others observe. As far as the hypomania, it doesn't necessarily require hospitalization in terms of the severity that it's thinking of. So that led to this discussion within the field of child psychiatry about what does this actually mean. We have a lot of kids that are being diagnosed 40 times more in an 8-year period with pediatric bipolar disorder that are being treated with medications that have proven benefit for bipolar disorder in kids. Even there are some that are indicated, as well as for kids that have irritability associated with autism spectrum disorder. So there are some studies within the field of child psychiatry that fit with pediatric bipolar disorder, but not so much when we come to be thinking about this persistent irritability when it lacks an episodic nature, when it doesn't come on and when it doesn't go away, but when it's a chronic daily sort of an irritability. And so it led to this discussion within the field of phenotypes, right? So phenotypes, we think of an external, an observable manifestation of the genes, essentially, right? So what's inside is actually expressed. So there's another way of describing it there. And it led to this idea of a broad versus narrow phenotype. Broad being that the chronic irritability that we talked about, that is present day in and day out, fits with a broad phenotype of pediatric bipolar disorder, and accordingly would continue to be diagnosed as a pediatric bipolar disorder. Conversely, is a narrow phenotype. The narrow phenotype, again, within the world of child and adolescent psychiatry, said specifically that we need to stick to those same criteria that fit for adult bipolar disorder, that it should have a significant, unequivocal difference that includes episodic changes. That just persistent throughout the day is not bipolar disorder. And so it became this tension within the field of child psychiatry. A lot of letters to journal editors, a lot of feelings about it, and understandably so, because many people had started to think of their child, of their loved one, in a certain way and had started a treatment accordingly. And so the National Institute of Mental Health decided to investigate it a little bit further. They came up with a set of words, another name called severe mood dysregulation, SMD. And they started to look into this a little bit more. They defined it as recurrent temper outbursts and a persistent negative mood. In a future slide, we'll go through specific criteria that they had as well, right? Because in psychiatry and mental health, why wouldn't we want a criteria, right? You have to do this and this and this, and we'll take one from here and another from there, and then we'll make a diagnosis, right? As opposed to being able to just get a blood level and say, yep, your sugar's high, you got diabetes, right? But we have all these things put together. And so they made their own sort of set with severe mood dysregulation and studied it. And what they found in the studies is that for those that had persistent negative mood and temper outbursts, that it coincided quite a bit with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and oppositional defiant disorder. Over 75% of the time. And anxiety disorders, 58% of the time. But the question is, that's fine, because certainly there are people that have bipolar disorder that have ADHD and have anxiety disorders. In fact, it's not all that uncommon, even for kids, right? But the question was, for those that had the severe mood dysregulation that were persistently irritable, that persistently had a negative mood, that persistently had temper outbursts, did they end up going on at any point to have an episodic sort of hypomanic or manic presentation? And what they found with this study over 2 years, 84 people with this sort of constellation, the severe mood dysregulation, and 93 with the bipolar disorder over that 2 years, is that of those that had the severe mood dysregulation, 1.2%, one of the 84 with the severe mood dysregulation went on to, in that 2 year period, to have manic, hypomanic, or mixed episode symptoms. Whereas in the 93 that had the bipolar disorder, 58 of those, or 62%, did go on within that 2 year period to have that sort of a presentation. So, well, that's only 62% that did, right? So not everyone did. So what about those other 38%? And also, well, this is only a 2 year period, right? So 2 years is kind of a short little time. So with any study, we ought to think, well, furthermore, we have 84 and 93, so doing some higher order math, that's clearly less than 200, right? So we're extrapolating for the whole country for a whole set of diagnostic idea based off of less than 200 people. So what'd they do? Bigger study, right? So this time we had a whole 776 people that looked at these same sort of points, chronic and episodic irritability at three time points. The three time points that they looked at were when they started, late adolescence, and then early adolescence. And so again, these are people that are specifically with the severe mood dysregulation that they're defining as distinctly different than a pediatric bipolar disorder. And what they found is, for those that had the chronic irritability, that there was a greater similarity of people within a group than across the groups. Meaning, if you're in early adolescence, when you started and you're almost 14 years old then by late adolescence, 2 years later, you are more likely to have symptoms fitting for ADHD as opposed to bipolar disorder. Then they move it on another 6 years that they looked at, and for those, they were more likely to present with depressive sorts of symptoms. Now, if they had episodic irritability that came and went, what they found at both of the time points that it actually did fit for a bipolar disorder. So there was some difference that they were finding in terms of these kids, the 776, over this, I mean, less than 10-year sort of period, that were distinctly different in terms of the symptoms that they looked at. But again, we're kind of looking at words, right? And we're still looking at a total of 10 years. So what'd they do? Well, let's look a little bit longer, right? So the same cohort, they continued for a 20-year follow-up. At that point, what they found is those that had the chronic irritability in adolescence that we already just started with it predicted that they would have dysthymia, which by DSM-5 now is, instead of dysthymia, because we might as well change it, is a persistent depressive disorder, right? Instead of dysthymia. But again, something that is not episodic, actually. By nature of dysthymia, it continues at a not full major depressive episode state, but kind of a semi-depressed state for some time. It doesn't come and go. A generalized anxiety disorder, or major depressive disorder, which is notably different than episodic bipolar episodes. Like I said, how many times can I put episodic into a certain word or into a certain sentence? They continue with other studies, lest we think that it's just this one cohort, but they looked on for other studies and other groups, and they found, again, related to severe mood dysregulation, that those that presented with that were at higher risk for depressive and anxiety disorders, but not bipolar disorders. Furthermore, what they found is that there was a familial link, that for those that that had the severe mood dysregulation, they were less likely to have family members with bipolar disorder as opposed to those that had the narrow phenotype that we talked about, that had the specific episodes, that had the specific symptoms over that time. And so there clearly was a difference. And so again, though, we're stuck with words at this point, right? And we would like to have something that we could see, right? That we could measure, because we all would feel a little bit better if there's something measurable that we could see, which again is part of the bane of mental health. But the studies in this case were able to find in their investigation something in this regard. And as it continued on, there were a couple of different things specifically from bipolar disorder. While there were, while both bipolar disorder and patients with severe mood dysregulation or subjects with severe mood dysregulation, both had differences in terms of face emotion labeling ability, degree of subjective stress and frustrating tasks, or impaired performance on learned response with reversal paradigms. So a couple of different research metrics that they look as far as how they're doing this, and they look at that by fMRI, which is how oxygen is flowing to certain parts in your brain, and by event-related potential, which is like an EEG that is measuring electricity and conductance on the scalp, that there were differences, even though both had differences in, or both had changes from a control group, there were significant differences from severe mood dysregulation subjects to bipolar disorder patients. And in addition to that, we'll look at a little bit with one of those as far as face emotion labeling ability and subjective distress. We won't talk specifically about what they are, but certainly the studies go through what each of these are. But also there was this excessive arousal that fits with this neural circuitry difference that the amygdala, or that perception of fear part of our brain, and every place always talks about an almond. For some reason, you read about amygdala and you think almond because every time it says it's the size of an almond. Wherever you read it, it's always an almond, 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 almond. So the amygdala, almond, reacts differently in what they were looking at from severe mood dysregulation to bipolar disorder. There were some other changes, of course, that are right along here, but they're significant when we're thinking about irritability and chronic daily sorts of irritabilities. Because if we're having, well, and we'll talk about this in a minute, if we're having a difficulty identifying negative emotions and a harder time viewing neutral faces, well, then we're going to be thinking that things are a lot different than the person intended them to be. So this is one of the studies, some pictures that they used in one of the studies with the fMRI, looking at this. And for people that had this severe mood dysregulation, as well as those with bipolar disorder, that they viewed these on this part differently in terms of the intensity. These are all supposed to be faces of disgust, actually. And for the subjects, when they were looking at these, it was harder for them to identify this. They even have intensities for it. Similarly, with different facial features, different facial expressions, those emotions that we talked about in the last slide, it again was different. For those that had this severe mood dysregulation, what they actually found was that they had a harder time identifying the happy, fearful, and angry faces, whereas with bipolar disorder, they just had a harder time with fearful faces. So it does speak about the role of the amygdala in these people and how the brain is working differently. And so there clearly was a difference. So when we're thinking about this, though, we're thinking ultimately still, these are kids that are chronically irritable, that are having significant impairments in function due to their level of irritability. And so does it really matter whether we're diagnosing with a severe mood dysregulation, or being that that actually isn't a diagnosis actually, or a pediatric bipolar disorder? Does the treatment end up being different? So what's in a name? When we think about, why do you keep on saying what's in a name? And the question is, where does that line come from? Any guesses, actually? I'm sure there are a bunch of different places. I didn't know this, but I kept on thinking, I'm glad you guys are cultured, because I'm not.
Romeo and Juliet.
There we are, right? And what is the point in Romeo and Juliet when Juliet is asking this? Like, what's the point with your last name, right? I mean, why? I'm not so interested in the fact that you're a Montague and I'm a Capulet. I apologize because I'm not a very cultured person, clearly. But what's the point of it? The fact that yours is one and mine's another. So what's the point that one is diagnosed with a pediatric bipolar disorder as opposed to something else, that the research is showing that it corroborates with a severe mood dysregulation, whatever that is, because actually, the spoiler alert is that never made it into any sort of DSM. What they did actually is make some adjustments. So the DSM in DSM-5 did make these adjustments with this sort of diagnosis actually. Disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. On the far left, you see what the criteria for the severe mood dysregulation is, but the primary differences between severe mood dysregulation, which we've substantiated in terms of being notably different in terms of criteria, in terms of what people experience over time, as well as what they experience biologically by either the event related potential or the fMRI. But still, we don't have a whole lot of diagnoses about this, or a lot of studies actually about this disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. The funny thing is that the disruptive mood dysregulation disorder actually only came about after they toyed with the idea, as they're making this DSM-5, with a temper dysregulation disorder with dysphoria. So instead of pediatric bipolar disorder, they decided maybe temper dysregulation disorder with dysphoria to disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. And the author of this particular paper theorized or hypothesized that would actually be because they were concerned that mental health would be wandering into the realm of temperaments, and that we are very different in terms of thinking about temperaments, and is this an easy to warm child or an easy to console child. So it ended up being disruptive mood dysregulation disorder with all of its own criteria, right? Notably, that these have these same temper outbursts that we were talking about that are occurring 3 or more times per week, that it has to be present for at least 12 months, that there haven't been 3 months within that 12-month period without symptoms, that it's present in at least 2 settings, home, school, or with peers, that you have to have had symptoms, that you could not have this diagnosis made before 6 years old, and it cannot or it should not be made once you've hit 18 years old. And furthermore, to make it more clear, you have to have had symptoms that were recognized before you were 10 years old. So there it is, slicing and dicing this irritability that in this effort to say, you know, it's not quite fitting as far as the long-term outcomes for pediatric bipolar disorder, but here's how we're going to try and make it specifically different. The trick is that, and I guess we could go on to the rest of the symptoms about this, is that there were a lot of other sorts of things, being that some of the other confounders that may be there as far as oppositional defiant disorder specifically, or bipolar disorder for that matter, cannot be diagnosed at the same time or in the same sort of a way that disruptive mood dysregulation disorder is. So they are mutually exclusive in terms of when they can or cannot be diagnosed. But the point of this is to question, well, again, still, what's the difference, right? Is the treatment going to be different? part of the argument would be that, yes, the treatment would be different. In fact, in the DSM, they placed this diagnosis in the depressive disorders category, which means that the treatment, in addition to therapy as kind of a first line, would actually be more of an antidepressant as opposed to an antipsychotic or a mood stabilizer. And certainly there are a lot of different feelings one way or the other about that, but that is just the idea as to where that change happened. The other thing that we think about in terms of that chronically irritable child, if that really makes much of a difference to us at all. And the other part that I think we would want to bring up is the elephant in the room that we're thinking about when we've been talking about this for the past 45 minutes is, we've talked about bipolar disorder, we've talked about irritability, we've talked about disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, but what about trauma? Because someone who is traumatized, certainly studies show that you're going to be hyper-aroused, you're going to be on edge, you're going to be quicker into a fight or a flight, you're certainly going to have a different amygdalar fear perception response. And so how does that account for it? And there isn't necessarily a whole lot of literature parsing that out. We clearly know from the literature that people that have had an experience of childhood trauma are much more at risk for substance use disorders, psychotic disorders, mood disorders, or anxiety disorders. Furthermore, those that have a history of childhood trauma are more likely to have bipolar disorder and more likely to have a severe expression of bipolar disorder. In fact, if there's treatment resistance for bipolar disorder, it's often the question of how's the assessment for trauma been? And so that's part of the elephant, maybe, that we're wondering about this. We are certainly wondering if maybe that confounds this whole other part, but maybe that's just due to my training and interest in child and adolescent psychiatry, specifically at Cambridge Health Alliance, where we work with a lot of kids with significant trauma that's really kind of skewing my perception on it. But the literature and biologically, it would lead us to think in that sort of a way. So I guess that's where we come back to thinking. This trauma specifically is a little bit of an epigenetic sort of an issue, right? Epigenetics ends up being something that comes up a lot more nowadays, right? Something that's in the environment that adjusts how your genes act, right? Instead of it being a nature versus nurture sort of a discussion, it becomes a yes, it's likely both, right? In terms of this, and that's where trauma, the ACEs study comes about, adverse childhood experiences, comes about to also help us to consider this, that maybe irritability, if it is in fact atypical, has something to do with trauma or with a relationship or with an attachment. And that the irritability may, yes, have something to do with a difference in terms of how we perceive a threat, how we perceive interactions, and how we physiologically or relationally are able to regulate. There certainly is a lot more that the research shows on this, that there are clear, significant biologic differences in terms of this. But ultimately, when we come to the end here, we think about what's kind of the point of all of this. The DSM at some points is kind of a controversial manual of diagnoses to begin with. It's the question sometimes that people have of what's the point of a diagnosis anyway. Is this experience entirely different at any rate? And that ends up being part of the question as far as what we think possibly of irritability when we're thinking about children and how they're presenting, and if it is diagnostic, if it's something that would warrant treatment, or if it's something that does not, then maybe we should just kind of back off. But what the studies have shown, that there clearly are significant impairments, and it's spanned through the years from pediatric bipolar disorders increasing 40 times in an 8-year period, to where there's a whole new diagnosis to try and catch this a little bit better. It leads us to thinking about different treatments and what impact those treatments would have, whether it would be with therapy, of course, but also an antidepressant versus a stimulant if it's an ADHD versus an antipsychotic or a mood stabilizer. And so it leads us to a lot of questions about what future work still needs to be done to clarify this diagnosis. But ultimately, it does come back to us thinking about where we started, about this interest with family, with children, with how to help these kids so that it doesn't end up being a continuous battle and having the same level of impairment. And that's certainly the interest that I have with the irritable child, that there is a very relational component in many of these things. And such a group like DBSA offers that sort of relational component to be able to come, to have a support place where it can provide such a sense of community and such a hopeful environment. And so I appreciate the opportunity to have been able to come to talk about one small slice of child psychiatry and one small slice within irritability and the thoughts that it may be related to. So I thank you very much.